You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, July 6, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Director of Research at the States Project, Aaron Kleinman, will be joining us. Then we will be talking to Trita Parsi, co-founder and EVP of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, on the status of the Iranian nuke deal. Meanwhile, Highland Park shooter charged with 7 counts of murder. More charges coming. Giuliani, Graham, Eastman, all subpoenaed to testify to the Georgia special grand jury investigating Donald Trump and voter tampering. Vote tampering. Vote election interference. Boris Johnson hanging on by the skin of his teeth amid resignations and a possible new no-confidence vote. Former White House counsel Pat Cipollone to testify to the January 6th commission on Friday. Meanwhile, the DOJ sues Arizona over its new voter ID law. The federal judge throws out Trump's rollbacks of the Endangered Species Act. And lastly, speaking of Trump, Republicans are freaking over Trump's plan to announce his re-election campaign over the summer. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for being here. We got an early start. Joining me in my decision to wear something that will moray on camera.
Moray day.
Moray day. Emma Vigeland.
Hump day. Moray day. Yeah, this is going to, I mean,
Sam Moray is worse, to be fair.
Yeah,
but we both have like electric shirts on.
Yeah,
trying
right.
to confuse the cameras.
Yep. There it is, folks. Sometimes you got to keep the cameras in line by doing that.
All That's right, how you know the robots haven't taken over.
We got a lot to
keep
get
them in check.
Got a lot to get to get a lot to get to today. Let's start with this. As you know, there are about 13 states around the country that had trigger laws so that abortion was effectively banned in those states, the moment the Supreme Court announced its ruling in the Dobbs case that overturned Roe v. Wade. One of those states was Mississippi, and there was an attempt to stop the ban, the trigger ban in Mississippi from starting. That failed. Here is the hearing presided by a Judge Halford in Mississippi that ultimately allowed the ban on abortion to move forward. Listen to the way that she starts. This is in a United States court, state court in Mississippi. Just to give you a little sense of what's going on with this abortion ban.
In accordance with Judge Alford's standard practice, those of you who wish, you're invited to join us for a moment of prayer and reflection, brought by Reverend Calvin Cosnahan, serving as a special chaplain for today's session. Our others are requested to remain silent and respectful of the court decorum during this time.
Lord, we pray for the presence of your Holy Spirit in this courtroom today. We lay before you our passions, emotions, and anxieties concerning the issues involved in this case. We seek your truth, not our own. We seek your wisdom, not our own. Bless and inspire Judge Halford and her deliberations and judgments here today. Bless and inspire all those who address this honorable court to do so with a sense of your presence and your will for them today. Enlighten our minds, strengthen our spirit, and fill our hearts with love, wisdom, and understanding. Lastly, Lord, we pray that you grant that the cause of truth, justice, and humanity shall in no wise suffer in the proceedings today. We thank you, Lord, in advance for all that you're going to do in our midst. Amen.
Be seated.
All right. We don't need to hear any more. That was the and this is the thing that I think some Christian or folks who grew up in the tradition Christian tradition won't necessarily pick up. But that is a Christian prayer. It does not say Jesus per se, but it is a Christian prayer. We don't talk about the Holy Spirit in Judaism, and I suspect also not in Islam.
And the person who was delivering the prayer is a Christian minister. So, I mean, I feel like that makes it clear.
Right. And you must respect the court's decorum during that. You don't have to participate, but, you know, might be a little tougher. Get your case won if you're not with the program, as it were.
Or if you might look like you're not with the program.
And to be clear, the judge, Deborah Halford, refused to block the abortion ban despite a 1998 ruling from the Mississippi Supreme Court saying that the state constitution provides abortion rights. So that issue was never litigated. A statute was passed. It was a trigger law. Unlike what we were talking about with the EPA West Virginia case, there's no one necessarily to bring a standing on a law that's been passed that is contingent upon what the Supreme Court does until the Supreme Court does it. And then there are people facing the consequences of that. And then you decide that then you can determine that you have standing. The one, I think there is one abortion provider in the state, and that is going to close now.
I saw an interview with a Planned Parenthood, someone who's located in Mississippi. Never mind, not Missouri. But there are some located across borders. It's just going to take. Just look them up if you're in need of an abortion.
The North Dakota one is fundraising. The Red River Women's Health is moving to Moorhead across the river from Fargo.
Right.
I mean, so this is a problem we're going to have all around the country, and we're going to be talking to more and more activists in the coming days and weeks about what can be done on the ground at the moment. Today, in a moment, I'll be talking to Aaron Kleiman about what you can do in addition to helping fund those organizations that are going to be basically creating, you know, a modern-day underground railroad for maybe above ground. I don't know. It depends on what these rulings are going to be in terms of helping women get abortions and health care, broadly speaking. And we will get into that. Aaron Kleiman will be here to tell us which states you can get the biggest bang for your buck if you are looking to donate to state races that will change the dynamic in specific states and either prevent full-on abortion bans or help loosen abortion restrictions in these states. Very targeted way of, you know, for those of you who have some faith that elections mean something in these states, this is for you. And then, of course, we'll be talking to Trita Parsi. First, a couple of words from our sponsors. Mentioned this yesterday, multi-appearance on guest on this program. I haven't talked to him in a while on this show. Professor Eddie Glaude has a new podcast out, and says here, there always will be something distinct about our present day, yet history haunts us. American democracy is at crossroads, and we have to decide who we really are as a nation. History is Us is an important six-part documentary podcast series hosted by award-winning Princeton University professor Dr. Eddie Gloud. Journeys back to face the truth about race at the heart of the American story, from the aftermath of the Civil War, the mid-20th century struggle for freedom, the election of Barack Obama, and the current-day racial reckoning. History is Us asks questions about who we are as a nation, what race might reveal about our current crisis, and where we go from here. Through the voices of distinguished historians and scholars, this limited series gives listeners the background and education to understand how we got here and how we can all use history to clarify the choices before us. Listen to History is Us, presentation of Shining City Audio, C13 Originals, and John Meacham Studio. Available now wherever you listen to your podcast. I've had a couple of people have already IM'd and emailed me that the podcast is great. I haven't had a chance to listen to it, but check it out. Eddie Gloud is really smart and really thoughtful guy. Also, if you're going online and you're doing so without ExpressVPN, it's like leaving your kids with the nearest stranger while using the restroom. Most of the time, probably fine. But you never truly know who you're trusting, and you've always got to worry about it. That's the almost the worst part.
Yeah.
Well, don't risk the important things. Start using ExpressVPN now. Every time you connect to an encrypted network, your online data is not secured. Any hacker on the same network can gain access and steal your personal data. They can steal your passwords, your financial details, you name it. Whatever you got. ExpressVPN creates a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet so that hackers can't steal your data and sell your personal info on the dark web. Just fire up the app, click one button, and you're instantly protected. ExpressVPN works on all your devices like laptops, phones, and tablets, so you can stay secure on the go. I've got it on my phone. It is crazy easy to use. You open up the app, you press a big red button, boom, you don't even think about it. After that, you get a choice. If, let's say, you're trying to be in Los Angeles so that you can watch maybe a game on YouTube TV that's not necessarily in your area, bingo, bango, you can set it to a server in California. But which I understand is the way you can use it, but also,
you've heard.
I get, phishing emails, you know, and I always like to click on the link, but I will, always make sure that my VPN is on when I do, cause I want to see what the scam is. That's just me though. Secure your online data today at expressvpn.com/majority. Get 3 extra months free. That's expressvpn.com/majority. expressvpn.com/majority. Okay. I pre-recorded this interview with Aaron Kleinman yesterday afternoon. And so let's run that. And after Aaron, we'll be talking to Trita Parsi on the latest what's happening with the Iran nuke deal. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report joining me now via our video device, the Director of Research of the States Project, Project by Future Now. But folks can check it out at the States Project. What Aaron Kleinman, what is the URL that people might want to head over to on the States Project?
Statesproject.org. Everyone should check it out. We got a great site for everyone to see how they can make a difference at the state level.
All right. So how they can make a difference. A lot of people have been asking, what do we do, at least in the short run, in terms of a woman's right to choose? On the day that Roe v. Wade was overturned by the Supreme Court, there were 13 states set to have abortion bans. Based on these trigger laws, I think ultimately 10 did, and there's a couple more that will be coming online. And then there's 13 others that could that will likely ban abortion unless the States Project is successful. So, Aaron, with that lead in, what is the States Project specifically set to do in general, and then specifically, how will that help women who are seeking an abortion and, frankly, seeking medical care? You know, we talk about how many tens of thousands of ectopic pregnancies there are. I mean, on and on and on.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look at the map of the United States, every single state where the right wing controls the state legislature, pretty much all of them, the, you know, reproductive health is under threat in, to some degree. And so if you can flip those state legislatures, you are protecting those rights. You are protecting the ability to, you know, not just reproductive health, like you said, but also, you know, it looks like it's expanding to contraception. And then, of course, you know, like an ectopic pregnancy or something like that. Again, all of those issues, if you can flip control of state legislatures or maintain control of state legislatures, as the case may be, you can, you know, really protect health care for millions of people.
And we should say, I mean, it's obviously not limited to health care for women and autonomy over their bodies. But like you say, we're in an era now where the Supreme Court is gunning for individual rights, for things like voting rights. They're gunning for things like the federal government's ability to effectively regulate our air, our food, our financial systems, and on and on. A lot of these fights are going to take place on the state level. I mean, and you know, we've been saying, and you've been coming on the show for years talking about the importance of states. It's never been more important to have some control of these legislatures.
Yeah. You know, and right now, you know, so much of, you know, kind of what your life is like is determined by the zip code you're in, because the state government that you live under has so much control. And, you know, again, if you look at state legislatures nationwide, in any state where really kind of our allies are in control of a state legislature, then reproductive rights are protected. People are getting clean air. People are getting, you know, again, not just reproductive health, but also, you know, all sorts of kind of, you know, low-cost medicine. There are ways that state governments can really improve people's lives. But I think, you know, the Dobbs decision has really thrust reproductive rights into the fore of kind of what states really can't control. And it may be such a salient topic to so many people. And right now, again, it's who controls your state legislature determines that. And the margins of control for state legislature are so, so slim in so many of these states. It's literally a couple of thousand votes switching in 2020 would have led to massively different outcomes in a number of these states, states like Michigan, states like Arizona, states like Maine. You know, it really is on a razor's edge right now. And heading to 2022, you know, we know that there is the standard thermostatic public opinion that accompanies any incumbent presidency that will give headwinds to a president's party. But the fact of the matter is that, first of all, in a lot of these states, we're actually getting better maps in 2022 than we did in 2020. And the, you know, again, it's because the, you know, Democrats are not the incumbent party controlling so many of these state legislatures. You know, you can kind of get into people's heads like, hey, even if you're not happy with what's going on in DC necessarily, right now, the people in your state capital are vast that represent you are vastly out of line with your opinions on these really critical issues. And it's just getting that message out to people, people who we know have voted for, you know, candidates who will, you know, support people's lives instead of the far right. In the past, you know, they, you know, just getting that into their heads that who is in your state capital really matters. And the candidates that we're supporting really can actually improve your life, can protect things like the fundamental right to, you know, abortion and reproductive health care. That's the challenges.
Okay. I want to get back to that, to that dynamic in a second. But has there been any a crunching of like the likelihood of a the correlation between how a state legislature goes and how the state votes in terms of the Senate races and the presidential races?
You know, I mean, so typically there is a pretty strong correlation. you know, like, it's, you know, I think looking at kind of the 2020 results, there were just very few cross-partisan seats across the country, even in non-battleground states. So people tend to vote, but there are big differences in, there are swing districts. And again, if you look at a state like Michigan, for example, it used to be that a majority of the state Senate seats went for Trump. That made it very hard for Democrats to win a majority in the state Senate. But under the new maps, a majority of state Senate seats went for Biden. And similarly, Pennsylvania House, it used to be a majority of the House seats in Pennsylvania went for Trump. Now a majority of them went for Biden. So, you know, it is kind of the polarization and nationalization of elections has made itself known at the state level. But also there are opportunities to really, especially when the president isn't on the ballot, it's kind of, you can kind of try to get those swing voters on your side by really hammering home the fact that who is in your state capital really determines a lot of your fundamental rights.
The dynamic you just talked about in Michigan and Pennsylvania, is that a function of new maps that were drawn in the wake of the census?
Yeah. So, again, in 2020, so the Michigan Senate wasn't up in 20, but, you know, the Michigan House, their maps got a lot better too. And again, we were just a few thousand votes away from breaking right-wing control of the Michigan House in 2020. Maps got better. So it's, you know, you don't even really need to improve necessarily on the 2020 performance at the Michigan legislative level. You just need to basically do as well
as you do in the presidential election. And
yeah.
Because I'm just trying to set up, like, you know, because the as people are watching this and they're looking to see what can be done, the pitch that you have always made is the dollar for dollar, your dollars do more work on the state level in terms of supporting state races than in any other type of race, because there's fewer dollars there, and so you're a bigger fish in a smaller pond, essentially, with your dollars. And there is at least a correlation in terms of, like, you know, we always think about coattails, a leader at the top of the ticket providing votes for people down below. But the fact is, it also works the other way. If you've got vibrant candidates on a state and local level, they're bringing out voters that otherwise wouldn't come out, and they tend to vote up ticket in the same way they vote, for that specific senator. And so from your perspective, this is not a persuasion election. It is really a motivation and get out the vote type of situation.
Well, I'll take the first thing first, which is, you're absolutely right that the average competitive state, so I'm not just talking about, you know, uncompetitive, someone's running, you know, basically unopposed, but an average competitive state legislative election costs about 3% as much as a competitive U.S. Senate election. So if you want to think, so that's, you know, 33 times, your dollar goes 33 times further state legislative level than it would at the Senate level in a competitive race. And so, yes, absolutely. If you want to make a difference by donating, please go to stateprojectstatesproject.org. You can check out all sorts of ways where you can make a difference. The second part, I think there have been some conflicting studies on that. There was one study that came out, I think, 2 years ago, maybe it was last year, that showed that there might be some type of reverse coattails effect, as you said. There are other studies, though, that have been around a little longer that really haven't shown that. And so, you know, the jury's still out a little bit on that. But here's one thing that we can say about the effect of, you know, it's having a messenger who's a part of a community, who knows the people there, who can be who's really seen as a trusted person in there, can really help, you know, make inroads among a group of voters in an area. And, you know, it's, you know, there's nothing that shows that, you know, we know that we need trusted messengers. And if you look at the candidates that we've endorsing, they're people who've been involved in their communities for years and years, and you want those people going out there and campaigning. So, you know, even though there may not have been shown, like, there's not definitively shown whether there is a reverse coattails thing, you know, there may be one, but you still are funding people who are going out there and making the case to people in their community. And, you know, there's certainly nothing wrong with that.
All right. Well, let's take a look. You are, you're focusing on at the States Project, seven states. And let's talk about those. Let's start with Arizona. We'll do this. I don't know if we do it alphabetically. I can't figure that out. But Arizona.
Yeah. So in Arizona, again, we're one seat away from breaking unfettered right-wing control of the government in Arizona in both chambers. And again, you're talking about a switch of like 1,000 votes from 2020. The maps there are actually kind of about the same as they were in 2020. Arizona has an independent commission, and they have for a while. So, the maps kind of reflect a bit. It's a purple state. It's a purple map. And so, you know, you're really having these going to be closely contested elections, really, in like the Phoenix suburbs and the areas around Tucson as well. Arizona. And again, in that state, if you're really concerned, you know, in particular about, reproductive health, that's a state where, there are a lot of far right members of that legislature. And there are some who maybe won't go as far. You saw, for example, in the January 6th hearings, there's, you know, some people who haven't totally lost their wits. Those are chambers where every seat will matter in terms of just what laws get passed. And so Arizona is a state where, again, not just control of the chamber. I mean, ending unchecked right-wing control of the Arizona legislature would be huge. But any progress we can make there just helps the people of Arizona so much.
And we should say, like, you know, Democrats, I've seen the Republican candidates for governor. Hopefully the Democrats can win that governorship as well. All right, let's talk about Maine. With all due respect to my friends from Maine, I've spent a lot of time in Maine over my lifetime. What the F is wrong? Like, let's get rid of Susan Collins. Let's get rid of how is it? Like, what is going on there?
LePage.
I mean, come on.
The one issue with Maine is their state house map actually has a majority of districts that went for Trump in 2016 in the state. So you have a pretty obvious path for them to retake at least one house in Maine. And in Maine, we've made huge progress on so many issues. Again, that's a place where we actually have been able to lower the price of insulin. If you're mad about the federal government's inability to do that, look at Maine. They've been able to do that. We've had, you know, they've been able to really expand access to reproductive health care as well. Again, if that's a big issue for you too. Environmental issues, they've been, you know, really harping on clean air and clean water. It's a state where, you know, in 2018 we went in and we helped flip the state Senate and Janet Mills on the governorship. And so it's really shown the power just like since 2018, because you had Paul LePage in charge for the previous 8 years. And there's just been this huge reversal there. And it shows you what you can do if you change the composition of the state legislature. And it's a model for the rest of the country. But again, Maine voters are independent-minded. The maps, you know, may favor Republicans a little bit. And so you're heading into election where control of the legislature is unsure. And by the way, LePage is trying to make a comeback. So at the very least, if he's successful, then you at the very least want to make sure that he's checked by the state legislature. And so Maine's going to be a huge state to kind of lock in those gains, show people that, you know, improving lives is the way to kind of really gain and, you know, continue to have power. And yeah, so Maine is absolutely a state that you need to think about when you're thinking about state legislature elections in 2022.
And then there's a couple of states on here where I think like these are going to be huge in terms of both not just 2022, but also 2024, because you're setting, you know, all sorts of implications in terms of like voting rights and other things. Michigan is one of those.
Yes.
We have a Democratic governor in Michigan, Democratic AG, state houses. What's going on there?
Yeah. So I think in every election from 2012 to 2020, except for one, I think Democrats won a majority of votes in the state house in Michigan, but they didn't get a majority of seats in it. But in 2018, voters passed an initiative that put in place a bipartisan or not, so I should say nonpartisan citizens redistricting commission that's put in place pretty fair maps there. I would say the state Senate maps probably do a better job of like the state overall. The state House maps still have a slight Republican lean, but these are maps that, you know, we can win on in a neutral year. The people of Michigan can finally have their voices heard in the legislature. And if you want to talk about a state where the state legislature has a lot of power, in Michigan, there's actually, in their state constitution, if the legislature passes a law and then they can get a petition signed by 8% of the voters in the state, which ends up being, I think, something like 300,000 signatures, because it's based on the gubernatorial election, they can actually enact the law by going around the governor's veto. And so you can think about the implications for the state in all sorts of areas if the right continues to control the legislature. And if they, you know, and they get tired of, you know, Gretchen Whitmer being a popular governor. And, you know, so it's a state where control of the legislature is absolutely critical. And we really do have a shot. Again, you don't need to do better than you did in 2020. You just need to do about as well, and you can win the state legislature.
And we should say that's a challenge because typically, the party out of power, the Democrats come out in much less numbers, in particular relative to the Republicans. But there are unique circumstances this year, both in terms of like what we saw with January 6th, but more importantly, I think the idea that for the first time in the history of the country, we had an individual right rolled back by the Supreme Court. It's never happened before. And we've denied 50 roughly a percent of the country an individual right that they had. Minnesota
again, another incredibly tightly controlled on both sides legislature. You Democrats, you know, if they can gain 3 seats in the state Senate, they'll take over. If they lose 3 seats in the House, then they'll lose control of it. And so again, tight, and you know, these are not very big districts, so it's really just like small numbers making a huge difference here. And you know, the new maps are like the old maps were kind of drawn by a court and they had a small Republican lean. They still kind of do, but they got like a little better overall. But you know, and again, it's you have kind of historically union heavy but kind of rural areas still represented by some Democrats that we need to defend, and we have really areas that are trending really sharply toward Democrats in the Twin City suburbs and around like Rochester that we can pick up. And so it's just a huge playing field there. You have small districts, again, a couple hundred votes makes all the difference here and there. And so, yeah. And again, you have the governor up too as well. And, you know, he's pretty popular. And the Republican nominee for governor there is a big anti-vax. But you know, in Minnesota, again, it's a swingy state. It could go either way, and you know, you could have control of the government that actually wants to protect those rights, or you can have a government that wants to do away with those rights. And it's going to be a razor's edge. And again, anything you can do there to help the state legislature just makes a huge difference.
Nebraska trying to prevent a supermajority. Let's talk about Pennsylvania. What's going on in Pennsylvania?
Pennsylvania is another state where in the House, we are going from, you know, a map where we're fighting with one hand tied behind our back to a map where it basically reflects the state from at a partisan level. It's 103 Democrats or 103 seats that went for Biden, 100 that went for Trump. And a state that Biden won by about 1%, it's, you know, maybe a little Republican leaning, but it's still one that, you know, you can win on. And again, Pennsylvania is a state where historically, you have these suburban areas that were willing to vote Republican down ballot because they didn't feel like their fundamental rights were really at risk because they had a federal prophylactic. Now that's gone, and you have a far right gubernatorial nominee who will sign any bill that he gets that limits those rights, and so. You need to make sure that, and you know, polls have that race close too. So you can't just kind of count on a Democratic governor to veto them like you can right now. And so the stakes are just so incredibly high in Pennsylvania.
That, they're Republican. Mastriano. Is Mastriano is his name?
Mastriano, yeah.
He's a lunatic. Full-on theocrat. Full-on theocrat. And any type of sort of like bulwark against him is going to be important. All right, lastly, let's talk about North Carolina. Again, this is one of those states that feels like it's like headed blue, but it's not quite there. And in fact, when you start to look at the numbers, you realize like it's not there at all in some respects, but it feels like it should be.
Yeah. So North Carolina, I mean, so if you, at the macro level in the state, you have really exurban areas have really grown in Republican strength as kind of urban suburban areas have grown in Democrat. So it's kind of like, it's a bit of an arms race and Republicans kind of just have this edge and they keep maintaining that slight edge. There are a couple important things about North Carolina. First of all, the state house maps are actually relatively fair. I know we're not used to saying that at all about maps in North Carolina, but they basically were able to cut a deal but it also means that they're fair, but also they still lean Republican. And in a good year, there are just a lot of like narrowly Democratic seats that are at risk. And so in a good year for Democrats, they could actually win control of the chamber. But in a bad year, they could lose so much that Republicans get a supermajority. And why is that important? Well, the governor of North Carolina is a Democrat, Roy Cooper. He can veto any legislation that comes to his desk, but if Republicans get more than 3/5, which you need in North Carolina to override the gubernatorial veto, then they could pass all sorts of regressive laws. And so in a year where it looks like we may be facing headwinds, it's really important just to be, really focused on making sure that they don't get that supermajority, which they're only a couple of seats away from. I think, if they win 3 seats, if they net 3 seats right now, then they would have a supermajority and they could override gubernatorial vetoes. And so you really need to hold the line there in the House if you want to protect those rights.
So what does the state's project do? I mean, like, what do you do? So I donate some money to you. What do you do? Not just you, but the whole project.
Yeah. So, again, it's all about, making sure that we are using, we try to have evidence-based methods whenever we can to make sure that we are, and this is, again, just our PAC. We also have, a policy arm that, really helps lawmakers figure out, ways that they can really improve the lives of people in their states. But in terms of the electoral work that we do, first of all, if you donate, like, for example, to our GiveSmart program at statesproject.org, all that money goes directly to the candidates. We don't actually take it. But if you do want to donate to us, which I, heartily endorse as well, we basically spend a lot of time trying to figure out the best ways that we, to the extent that we do, with any electoral funds spend, make sure that it's in the most effective way. I think one thing that we talk about broadly, because I don't really want to get into what exactly we're doing. I don't know who's watching this right now.
Hold what are you looking at? One second. I'm looking at my, you can't hear it. Shoot. I was going to do my mystery, sound drop, but yes, of course you guys are doing some type of like mathematical analysis and you are looking at specific clients, candidates, and you are going to send money there and you do not want to tip off the Republicans where you're deploying your resources, right?
We don't want to get to, but I can talk broadly about kind of some of the things we do. And one actually really exciting thing we do in a few states, it's called the door knocking challenge. And basically the number one way that a candidate can persuade someone to vote for them is to actually go and talk to them. And the best way to find persuadable voters is using your voter list and finding out the people who might be swing voters and going to talk to them personally. That means going door to door. And so we actually have a door knocking program where basically the candidates that knock on the most doors end up getting kind of the, they end up winning like the most donations from us. And it's just like, we want to make sure we incentivize good candidate behavior whenever we can. And one thing I've seen across all tactics, especially when you follow the data, it all comes down to meeting people where they are. It's a lot. Like, that's what the door knocking challenge is. That's like a lot of like any type of paid media campaign is. You're always just trying to meet people where they are.
Psychologically or like literally?
like both, but it's really just like, you know, so many people, like, you know, it used to be that, you know, and it still is important that you do like ads during, like, you know, talking about North Carolina, ads during the UNC Duke game. Hey, those will reach a lot of people in the state. But, you know, hey, not everyone might tune into that. And so it's like what they might actually, or not everyone's paying attention to those ads. And so it's finding other ways to kind of find out where people are and getting the message in front of them that, you know, what we've been talking about here. It's like, regardless of what you think about the direction of the nation or what's going on in Washington, D.C., the fact of the matter is that so much of what you hold dear is at stake in your state capital, and the right-wing candidate on your ballot holds views that are just so far out of line with what you believe. And you just got to get that in people's heads. Right. And that's what the challenge of all of this is really meeting people where they are to get that message out and making sure that states, you know, right now, Republicans have, you know, control of state houses outsized to their popularity. And there's nothing, especially now that we have fair maps in a lot of states that we didn't before, there's nothing that says that we can't take that back. There's nothing that says that ultimately we can't make states a bulwark against them. Right. But it's
we're going to have to.
And starts now.
Aaron Kleinman, Director of Research at the States Project. Folks can go there at statesproject.org. You can donate money to the States Project, or you can donate to the GiveSmart program, which gives the money directly to targeted candidates who have the best chance of winning based upon the data, as Aaron calls it. Some say data. We're not going to argue about that right now. Aaron is sitting there crunching every day. So if you want your dollars to be most effective in terms of changing your state's policies or protecting a woman's rights in that a person's rights in that state, this is a great way to do it. Aaron, thanks so much for your time. We'll put
thank
a link
you so much,
at majority.fm. Don't say anything about the Yankees. All right. Appreciate the call. Talk to you later. All right, Aaron. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam.
We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Trita Parsi, who's the co-founder and executive vice president, the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, here to give us an update on the JCPOA, which, for the life of me, I don't understand why you give something an acronym if it's completely unpronounceable. But that is the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the Iran deal, I think, as people understand it, that was forged by Obama in the final year of his presidency. So, Trita, thanks for joining us. Where are we right now? Because things have happened in the past, I guess it's 2 weeks, on some level. At least there's been a slight change in our status as opposed to, I guess, 3 months ago.
I don't know really if there is much of a change. We're in no good place, let me put it that way. There was another round of indirect talks in Qatar in which the U.S. and Iran negotiated through the European coordinators, but it appears to not have led to anything. The two sides are still stuck. The U.S. side is saying that the Iranians were even increasing their demands. And in the U.S. perspective, the Iranians are making demands on matters that are outside of the JCPOA. The Iranian view is that, at least when it comes to the delisting of the IRGC from the terrorist list, that is not outside of the JCPOA, since the Trump administration explicitly put the IRGC on the terrorist list or on the FTO list in order to sabotage any potential U.S. return to the JCPOA. And this has now been going on for quite some time, that we're in this deadlock, almost in this zombie state for the JCPOA. It's not quite dead, but it certainly doesn't seem to be alive.
All right, let's go back a little bit and just remind people, so that for folks who haven't maybe been really too in tuned into what is going on. The Obama administration forges this deal that is narrowly crafted about the Iranian nuclear program. It didn't necessarily deal by design with other things that the U.S. may have a problem with, Iran supporting, Hezbollah, or Iran supporting other groups that might, or maybe their influence in Iraq, or whatever it was that other people might have issues with. It was narrowly tailored specifically to deal with the nuclear program. What were the terms of that? Just set the basic outline for us so that we can know what Trump did to both in unilaterally leaving this deal and in sort of like salting the earth a little bit.
So this is a remarkable diplomatic achievement, in my view. The United States, together with the Europeans, together with Russia and China, and negotiated for more than 2.5 years intensely with the Iranians and came to a genuine compromise in which the Iranians agreed to significantly reduce and inhibit their nuclear activities. They shipped out 98% of their low-enriched uranium. They agreed to cut their centrifuges, these machines that you use to enrich uranium, from 22,000 to only 5,000. Essentially, the combination of all of these measures led to a situation in which if the Iranians made a decision to build a nuclear bomb, it would still take them a full year minimum to have the material for the bomb, and then another 2 to 3 years to be able to actually build the bomb. So it created a really tremendous comfort zone for the United States. And in return, the Iranians not only got sanctions relief, which is obviously very important, but it was more important that it was an end of an era of American containment of Iran. No longer was the U.S. trying to exclude Iran from all diplomacy in the region, from all bodies in the region. The U.S. had insisted that the Iranians could not be involved in the negotiations about Syria. As soon as the JCPOA was concluded, then the U.S. made a 180 and was 100% in favor of the Iranians being at the table in order to try to find a diplomatic solution to the civil war in Syria. Then Trump comes in, and after about a year and a half, he pulls out of the deal, despite the fact that his own State Department twice certified that the Iranians had lived up to the end of their bargain, despite the fact that 14 reports from the IAEA had confirmed that the Iranians were living up to all of their obligations. This was a deal that was working, but Trump nevertheless pulled out of it. For about 13 months, the Iranians didn't do anything. They continued to be in full compliance, hoping that the Europeans would step in and provide Iran with the sanctions relief that the U.S. now had deprived them of. The Europeans failed to do so. And as a result, after 13 months, the Iranians started to reactivate certain elements of their program. They're still in the deal. They're still living up to most of the deal's provisions, but they started to reduce their obligations in a way that actually is highly, highly problematic. They didn't leave the deal altogether because they were hoping that once the next president of the United States would come into the White House, America would come back to its senses and rejoin the deal. That is what Biden promised to do. That is what a lot of groups had prepared a political ground for him to do. In fact, the Democratic Party platform stated explicitly that the United States should return to the JCPOA. But Biden chose not to go back right away. He could have just done an executive order, as he did with the Paris Agreement, as he did with the WTO, as he did with the Muslim ban. Instead, he spent the first 2-3 months negotiating and consulting with the Israelis, the Saudis, and the Emiratis, the only three countries in the world that actually oppose the JCPOA, in order to kind of get them on board. And right, the way the Iranians...
I want to stop there and start to tell that history in a moment. But just looking back, what did the Europeans... What could they have done, or and why didn't they do what could have been done in terms of providing Iran with most of the benefits of the deal?
There's plenty that they could have done. There's almost nothing they could have done, however, that would not have caused the Trump administration to start punishing Europe.
Okay.
And the Europeans didn't want to take that cost. And then they also calculated that the Iranians would stay in the deal anyways. And as a result, it certainly wasn't worth the cost for them to pick yet another fight with Trump or vice versa, that Trump would pick a fight with them.
So everybody, the Europeans and the Iranians, are waiting for Biden to come back into office. They know that he was part of the administration that forged this deal in the first place. One would imagine that there was even more of a compulsion to get back into this deal quickly than, you know, I don't know how you measure these things with the Paris Accords, but I mean, this was really, in many respects, Obama's, you know, domestically, people can argue the ACA, but certainly, and from my perspective, one of the top line accomplishments of the Obama administration that is very hard for anybody to look at, aside from, I think, the neocons, to look at and say, there was a problem with this. I mean, it was almost like textbook what you want to have happen with that type of I guess pariah. And also let's talk about what Biden didn't do, and then we can talk about these dynamics between the Abraham Accords and the sort of the proxy war and the what the Biden administration is doing is sort of trying to build on the Abraham Accords. It's almost made it a decision on, you know, which of two paths could be followed, and they've left the Obama path on some level. But let's talk about what Biden did first coming in and why, because it seems like in those first 3 months, he could have done the executive order there and no one would have paid attention, because we're just going back to status quo. And but yet he didn't. And like, why?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think whatever the political price would have been if he had done it on day one or on the first week, it is incomparable to the political price that he would be paying today or 6 months ago if he had managed to get to an agreement with Iran. So the political cost in the first week or so, or the first month of the administration, was much, much lower. But he didn't choose to do this for a couple of reasons. One, there was a fear in the White House that if he did this, if he didn't do an extra effort to get the Israelis to calm down, then he would have a major fight with Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu. Back then, Netanyahu was still Prime Minister, during Biden's first year in office. And mindful of the many, many domestic political crises that he had to deal with and the political capital he had to spend on that, it appears the Biden administration simply wanted to avoid that and instead then focused on consultations with the Israelis and the Saudis, etc.
Well, I mean, just Israel being so integral to the dissolution of the Iran deal during the Trump administration, and then Biden really cowering from it. I mean, people may forget that Netanyahu gave some weird PowerPoint presentation where he claimed that Iran was lying about nuclear weapons, which was not borne out by any of the facts on the ground. Can you just flesh out that mini history there so we can understand a little bit why Biden's so terrified today?
Remember, when the JCPOA was concluded, there was a big fight in Congress as to whether Congress would go along with it or not. And Netanyahu did something unprecedented. He got an invitation by the Republican leadership in Congress to come and give a speech against the sitting president of the United States. He went to unprecedented levels in picking a fight with the U.S. president. A lot of folks in Israel were very unhappy about this because the United States is the most important partner, ally of Israel. And to do so against the president and to do so against the democratic president, which I think was somewhat deliberate from Netanyahu's perspective, it was an added benefit for him to further turn support for Israel into a Republican issue rather than a bipartisan issue because of many challenges and problems he had with the Democrats. So there were folks in the Biden circle who felt that they could not afford to repeat this, and they wanted to do this consultation with the Israelis. I can tell you others in the Obama circle, Ben Rhodes, very explicitly during the transition pleaded in his podcast with the Biden folks not to go down that path, because thinking that there was anything the United States could do to appease Netanyahu is in and of itself a major mistake. And I think history has proven Ben Rhodes right on this one, because the path Biden went down created the very same problems that we're dealing with right now.
And doesn't, I mean, I don't want to sidetrack this too much, but wasn't Netanyahu on record as indicating, conceding, admitting, whatever it is, that the primary source of political power that Israel has within the context of American politics is now coming from the right anyways, that the Democrats, that even the Jewish community in the United States votes with the Democrats 75% of the time, that his support is coming from basically the Christian Zionist community.
Exactly.
And
this has been the working theory of Netanyahu. And, you know, the Jewish community tends to be quite progressive.
Yeah.
Even if they support Israel, it's not their number one issue. Whereas evangelical Christians, his theory said, would be much more in support of Israel and much more blindly in support of what Israel is doing, yeah, and not raising some of the questions that progressive Democrats in Congress, Jewish and non-Jewish, are raising in a much, much greater scale than they did before.
So
as a result, he wanted to shift the base to the Republicans. So going after Obama was, you know, again, it was not a side effect. It was an added plus. And the Biden folks thought that they could break that.
Well, I was wondering, because they thought they could break it, which is, of course, delusional in my mind. But it's also the added benefit to the Biden people is that, yes, we're going to piss off the base of people who will never, ever, ever, ever vote for us. The third coming of the Messiah could come, and they're not going to vote for the Democrats. It's just not happening, like, definitionally. So it's almost the definition of a freebie, right? I mean, if you're going to piss anybody off, pissing off Bibi Netanyahu is the one person you could piss off that is actually not going to have the at least the popular political price that you would pay if you're a Democratic president.
Especially when he's reliant on United States aids. The relationship is entirely flipped. It just boggles my mind.
I agree with you. I think the calculation of the Biden administration on this point is quite erroneous. Let me also add that another problem that exists is that the Biden team thought that it was essential to make sure that the terms of the JCPOA were changed. They wanted a longer and stronger deal. And they wanted the Iranians to upfront commit to negotiating a longer and stronger deal as a condition for the United States returning to the original agreement. And there's a tone deafness here, because here's the United States. It pulled out of the agreement. It reimposed sanctions on Iran that were devastating to the Iranian economy. Iran's middle class was an estimated 45% of the population. It shrunk to roughly 30%. 10 or 11 million people were pushed into poverty as a direct result of these sanctions. And now, instead of going back into the agreement and kind of taking responsibility for the damage that has been caused, and perhaps be a bit appreciative that the deal still exists despite of the actions of the United States, the Biden administration goes to the Iranians with demands and says, you know, in order for the U.S. to come back in, there has to be a renegotiated and a longer and stronger deal. The signal that sent to the Iranians essentially was, it's not Trump that was the aberration. It was Obama. And that if there's going to be a negotiation for a longer and stronger deal, well, then Biden is going to use Trump sanctions, which still are in place a year and a half into this, as leverage for those negotiations. And then Iran needs to have its own leverage. And that prompted the Iranians to then significantly accelerate the expansion of their nuclear program, including starting 60% enriched uranium, something they didn't even start under Trump. All of that has led to a situation in which today, the breakout capability that I mentioned earlier on that was 12 months under the deal has now shrunk to roughly 8 to 10 days.
Right.
So the leverage the U.S. thought, the Biden team thought that they would have by keeping the sanctions in place and renegotiating the deal has been completely canceled out by the fact that the Iranians are more advanced in their nuclear program than they ever have been.
I feel like I'm one of the least diplomatic people I know. And yet, the idea that Iran has domestic politics, that you have hardliners and you have reformers, and the political power of the reformers is so closely tied to the idea that Donald Trump, even though America backed out of this deal, it was Donald Trump who backed out of this deal. And Donald Trump comes around once every 100 years, you know, maybe for the American presidency. And when Biden gets back in, we're going to be back to normal and we can trust them. I mean, how much of the Iranian reform movement was tied to that premise, and which we, I mean, seemingly had no knowledge of or complete disregard for, because we've shattered that, haven't we?
Unfortunately, I think you are quite right on this. I think it's important to recognize in June of last year, the Iranians had their elections, presidential elections. The Biden team knew very well that in order to be able to have a frictionless return to the JCPOA, they needed to move fast because the window was essentially just 3 or 4 months long, because already by March, April, the Iranians were deep into their political season. So if something needed to happen, it needed to happen fast. Otherwise, we would risk not only dealing with a new president in Iran that was conservative, most likely would be a president or at least a team that would be skeptics or if not opponents of the JCPOA. That was a critical reason to move fast rather than to move slow. Biden team members recognize this. They said it themselves during the transition that the window is short. Yet, we squandered that window. Now, what did that do to the Iranian reforms? Well, part of the theory of the Iranian reformists was that much of Iran's problems, internal, external, will be resolved if the United States and Iran can come to terms with each other and resolve some of their biggest problems. Not everything is America's fault. Iran needs to change as well. And if a good compromise can be found, then that will be beneficial to Iran, and Iran can move in a much better direction, including internally when it comes to openness of society, democracy, etc. That theory was clearly only held by the reformers within the Iranian elite. But the Iranian people spoke in 2013. They elected Rouhani on that platform, gave it a shot, and lo and behold, it actually worked, because the deal was struck, sanctions were lifted. But then Trump comes in, reneges on it, and it appears as if the hardliners in Iran actually were right. You could really not trust the United States. The United States invariably would betray the agreement. But you could still make the point, well, it's Trump. Trump is an aberration, happens once every 100 years. You can't rule out that this still could work. But then Biden comes in, ignores the fact that the Iranians are having this election, moves slowly, wants to use Trump sanctions as leverage in the negotiation, and then tighter basis of the reformist theory then falls apart. Because here's Biden, the former vice president of Obama, and he's essentially continuing the idea of Trump, which was, I want a better deal, and I want to renegotiate that by pulling out of this agreement. This was devastating. And the hardliners in the Iranian elections in 2021 used that extensively. Now, they, in my view, cheated and did everything else to make that election unjustified and illegitimate. But nevertheless, part of the reason why 20 million voters that had voted for Rouhani only 4 years earlier stayed home and didn't vote at all was because they had lost confidence in the idea that resolving tensions with the United States was the best path for Iran to resolve its own problems.
Remind us what the Abraham Accords are, and then tell us what the Baghdad Dialogue is, because it feels like the Biden administration was influenced by people who want them to go in one direction in the Middle East versus the direction that the Iran deal could have set us in. It's sort of like illustrated on some level, or at least analogized by the Abraham Accords and the Baghdad Dialogue.
So the Abrams Accord is something that Netanyahu had pushed for some time, and it's only thanks to Trump and Jared Kushner that it could come into existence. Essentially, the theory is, why bother resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? Forget about that. Let's just normalize relations with some of these other Arab states, ignore the Palestinian issue, have a bunch of trade, a focus on a joint enmity with Iran, and that way there's no need to undo Israeli settlements on Palestinian territory. There's no need for a two-state solution. As long as the other major Arab states essentially succumb to what Israel has done, then we have succeeded in what the Abrams Accord document says, moving beyond the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. So it's in some ways honest. It's not trying to resolve it. It certainly is not a peace. It's about sweeping that issue under the rug and forget about the fact that millions of Palestinians continue to live under occupation. This was heavily criticized by people in the region, of course, by the Palestinians, but also by a lot of people in Washington when Trump was doing it. When the Biden folks first came in, they tried to keep a bit of a distance from it. They didn't want to be too closely associated. I think that at some point they were toying with the idea of changing its name. But in essence, they have continued that effort. They've been raising the prospect of Indonesia and Malaysia normalizing relations with Israel without Israel doing anything to come to terms with the Palestinians, and have been met with rather angry reactions. Now, the prize in all of this is to get the Saudis to normalize with Israel. The reason why it's considered the prize is because it was, at least in the past, indicative of the fact that the Saudis would only come to such an agreement if the Israeli-Palestinian issue had been resolved. These Saudis put forward the Beirut Declaration in 2002, in which they offered to recognize Israel, and all Muslim or Arab states would do so, granted that Israel would recognize a Palestinian state. So the idea of getting Saudi to do so was important because it's such an important country in the Muslim world, but also because they had stated clearly they would only do so if there also was a Palestinian state. If you now can get the Saudis to normalize with Israel without any movement on the Palestinian state, then you would take the Abraham Accord to the next level. Those in the White House that are involved in it would get their names written into the history books. But let's be very clear about one thing. It will not bring about peace between Israel and Palestine. On the contrary, it will cement that conflict. It will further inflame that conflict. And we will go in a very bad direction. But many of these people, I think, calculate that that's okay because the world doesn't care about the Palestinians. They don't care about that issue in the manner that they did 20, 30 years ago. The Palestinian issue, in their estimation, does not have the same capacity to be able to motivate other countries in the Middle East in a way that was the case 30 years ago, 40 years.
And is that because Netanyahu and the far right in Israel has just done such a good job at naturalizing that apartheid and naturalizing that subjugation, that countries like Saudi Arabia that, you know, have a lot to offer in capitalist terms are just more willing to go with money and along with the rest of the Western world as opposed to, you know, having a stance on this?
This has been the strategy of the right all along, that if you just wait long enough, the world will forget about the Palestinians and they will come to terms or be forced to accept that Israel is going to annex essentially all of Palestinian territory, that the green lines, the mandates from the UN and all of those things are part of history and no longer relevant because facts on the ground have changed. That's the entire premise of the settlement strategy, of making it impossible to have a Palestinian state and eventually get the rest of the world to succumb to that that perception. And it seems to be working quite well. I mean, this has been a vindication for, you mentioned how what Biden is doing has undermined the Iranian reformists. Well, imagine what the Abrams Accord, and particularly an expansion of that, does to the Israeli left, the ones that actually wanted to come to a compromise with the Palestinians, the ones that actually did believe in a two-state solution. To the, much of the Israeli public, I would assume at this point, the Israeli right has been proven right. As long as you just go forward with more settlements, more annexation, eventually the rest of the world will lose interest and simply accept it.
And so the Abrams Accord basically creates two pariahs, right, in the region. It is the Palestinian people and the Iranians. The Palestinian people become less of a concern because they have no mechanism. If you bring on board enough other countries, they have no mechanism in which to get resources. And the Iranians become sort of like the bête noire, I guess, of everyone else in the region, and becomes the organizing principle. How do we fight, contain, destabilize Iran? And that's sort of the, and as we see this sort of rapprochement between the Biden administration and MBS in Saudi Arabia, that's got to be a big issue that they're talking about, right? I mean,
I would almost go a step further. I would say that having that enmity with Iran, the Arab-Iranian enmity, the U.S.-Iranian enmity, is a necessary condition for the Abrams Accord to come into fruition and for it to be able to endure. If you take away that enmity, the whole thing collapses. This is actually fascinating because only 50 years ago, the tables were turned. The Israelis and the Iranians actually had a quiet alliance because they sensed a shared threat both from Arab states such as Egypt under Nasser and Iraq under Saddam Hussein, but also from the Soviet Union. Now, in order for that alliance between Israel and Iran to sustain itself, the Israelis believed Iranian-Arab tensions needed to be kept alive. So when the Shah in the early 1970s started to improve relations with Egypt, he actually ended up having a very good personal relationship with Sadat. The Israelis were freaking out and they were fearing that Iran eventually would abandon its alliance with Israel, because if it manages to improve relations with the Arabs, then it would not need Israel in the same way. I interviewed a senior Iranian minister from the government of the Shah about this, and he almost angrily told me, Iran did not have Israel as a friend in order to have the Arabs as an enemy. But we are now going down the path in which we're going to go for a fake peace on one side of the Middle East, Israel-Palestine, in order to have an actual enmity and conflict on the other side of the Middle East. It makes no sense for the region. It certainly makes no sense, in my view, for U.S. national interests, because this is cementing conflict. This is not resolving conflict. Not on the Palestinian side, nor on the Arab-Iranian side. It may sell a lot of weapons, but it's not going to bring peace, rest assured.
Yeah, everything you're saying may in fact be the feature as opposed to the bug, as they say. Lastly, tell us about the Baghdad dialogue. So that at the very least, I mean, it seems like it provides at least a potential model. You know, it's so hard to understand that there are actually people with functioning brains in the administration who think that we still need to be entangled in these conflicts in that region, particularly when we have, at least it seems to me, a fairly good sense of what it would take to minimize the conflicts.
Yeah. So, you know, oftentimes when we go down these paths, the foreign policy establishment presents it as the only viable option. Nothing really existed. There were no alternatives. And if there were one, those were naive, et cetera, et cetera. this is tremendously far from the truth. There's clearly alternatives. First of all, what Obama did with the JCPOA, as you correctly said it earlier on, it was a very narrow agreement, but it was a narrow agreement with an explicit promise of being the beginning of a broader diplomatic effort. It was not supposed to stop and end with a nuclear file. It was supposed to start with that and move that out of the way so that the U.S. and Iran, Iran and regional states could start focusing on other issues. That never came to fruition as a result of Trump pulling out. But if we now go down the path of the Abrams Accord, Trump's policy, we are abandoning, in my view, even though the administration will make the case that both can exist at the same time, I'm less convinced of that precisely because the enmity with Iran is so necessary in order for the Abrams Accord to exist. In fact, if you listen to the language that the administration is using, it is constantly inflating the Iranian threat. And I think that is done deliberately because it's necessary for the fruition of the Abrams Accord. And you cannot have a nuclear deal expected to sustain itself and survive if you at the same time are ramping up tensions in order to justify the Abrams Accord. But also you have the Baghdad dialogue. The Baghdad dialogue is put together by the Iraqis. They are the ones that have been secretly providing a venue for the Iranians and the Saudis to talk, the Egyptians and the Turks. A lot of regional diplomacy has been taking place there. And what's so fascinating about this is that unlike the Abrams Accord that is organized against other states, the organizing principle is to essentially say, let's isolate that country, let's create a military pact against that country. The Abrams Accord is inclusive and is not organized against anyone. It's based on actually having the countries resolve their problems using diplomacy.
The Baghdad, that is something that the Baghdad dialogue.
The Baghdad dialogue, exactly. That is something that it has actually promise of bringing about peace and stability. It won't do well for the arms manufacturers and the arms sales, but it will do much, much good for the peoples of the region as well as the people of the United States who don't want to see the U.S. be entangled in more endless wars in the Middle East. The fact that we are potentially abandoning that for the Abrams Accord, I think, is a tremendous, tremendous problem. It is ironic beyond words that Biden would essentially continue Trump's rather than Obama's legacy in the Middle East.
And if I'm not mistaken, I think it was the State Department that issued a report saying the Abrams Accord, if fully realized, would create more international terrorism threat to the United States. I mean, it's basically creating a Middle Eastern NATO, if you will, and then also having to create the enemy so that you can justify the Middle Eastern NATO, and it will do so.
And you're absolutely right, and it's about sustaining that enemy, not losing that enemy. And my book on the Iran deal was called Losing an Enemy because that's exactly what it was. We were actually doing something to lose an enemy, which is something that terrifies people in many quarters in Washington, D.C. You mentioned that report. That's a secret Homeland Security report that got leaked by The Intercept, or leaked to The Intercept, and they published it. But don't take my word for all of this. Just go and read Tony Blinken's op-ed from 2017 in New York Times, in which he explicitly says that creating an anti-Shia, anti-Iranian bloc in the Middle East and masquerading that as a peace deal simply will not work. Those are his words. But this is now, unfortunately, apparently, also his policy.
All right, so final question. Is there anything that could change domestically in terms of politics in this country for the Biden administration that will change their perspective on this? In other words, the Obama administration did this in their second term. They had more, you know, the second term is, you know, when you become a little more bullworthy, I guess, to cite an old movie where it's, you know, it's we're going to let our hair down and do this stuff. Is that the same situation with the Biden administration? Because it feels like the constraints are of their own making and that there isn't the problem is less about the sort of like political constraints that are on the Biden administration and more about the will that exists initially.
I think you're quite right on this. This is not about political constraints. The JCPOA is very popular. Again, it was written into the Democratic Party platform. All of these different groups have paved the way for Biden to almost effortlessly to be able to go back in. It was not a political issue in my view. Now, there are arguments saying that, you know, would create problems with Netanyahu and he would create problems in Congress. That's maybe correct, but it's not a problem with the American people. Let's be very, very clear about that. I do also think that you're right, that it's an absence of political will and perhaps creativity. There's a comfort level for a White House to continue exactly this policy because it means that we continue to be friends with Israel. We continue to be buddy-buddy with Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. And that's much more comforting. That's much more comfortable for a White House than to go down the path that Obama did, which was, let's actually break things up a little bit. Let's resolve our tensions with Iran. Yes, it will not make the Saudis and the Israelis very happy, but it serves U.S. interests. And we can work things out with the Saudis and the Israelis afterwards. At the end of the day, where are they going to go? They still need the United States. But it will create political challenges and problems for a White House to go down that path, as the White House under Obama experienced. And I think it really comes down to this. It's not that they don't recognize that this would be a better path. It's just, it's too costly. It's too messy politically in D.C. And as a result, they don't want to do it. They prefer to go down this other path instead.
Drita Parsi, co-founder and executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Rob.
All right, folks.
Aha!
Yeah.
What are they doing? I don't know. Tony Blinken maybe should just focus a little more on this and not the rock band that he's in, right?
What is that song?
I don't know.
Lip service. Lip service to me. You give a lip service. Have you heard that song? Tony Blinken's song. It's amazing. Oh,
I love those like little those when you find out people are in bands. Like the Winklevoss twins have a horrible band.
At least they just do covers.
Right.
Well, this is what we had back in the day.
Oh yeah.
Only God, no other king. Let the mighty eagle soar.
This was our Attorney General under George W. Bush, and I think he sang this while he was Attorney General.
Young to die. She's still got a lot of God, no other king.
The Attorney General. Only God, no other king.
Wow. Sons of bitches.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. If you want this show to continue to survive and thrive, become a member today. Join themajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free half, free of commercials, you get the fun half and the glorious pride in knowing that you help this show grow and function on a daily basis. Also, you can support the show by many other ways. Go buy your coffee at justcoffee.coop. You won't feel bad about that because they're a co-op and they're free. They're fair trade. And they go beyond fair trade with their suppliers down farms down in Central America and I think some in Africa. They work with their farmers. If they have a bad season, they don't have as much production, instead of walking away from them, they work with them and figure it out so they can help them survive. JustCoffee.coop. If you use the coupon code MAJORITY, you get 10% off, too. And you can get the Majority Report blend. But they have a bunch of other coffees. But you could also, I don't know, give us a like on iTunes or subscribe on YouTube or subscribe on Twitch. Use your Amazon Prime dollars. It doesn't cost you nothing if you have Amazon Prime. You subscribe to us on Twitch. You get us down to a hype train type of situation.
Oh.
Poggers.
Nice.
Tell your friends. All that. So there you go. Going to be a crazy couple of years coming up, I have a feeling. So I don't know if they're going to be good.
Something will happen. Some things.
Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
Yeah, Lee Phillips is on, fresh off of our controversial episode about nuclear energy, for a second part on other types of, basically against degrowth, or a critique of degrowth is basically problematic, and like asking people who are, the focus on consumption is a little bit PMC, I guess is the short way to phrase it. So tonight, Lee Phillips, patreon.com/leftreckoning for the second part of that interview.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920 is the number. See you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What?
What is that going on? It's nuts. Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Unpacked. Matt.
Drew.
Unpacked.
What is up, everyone?
Unpacked. Nomi Keen.
You did it.
Unpacked. Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, today?
Yes.
Me? Is it?
Yes.
Is it me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello? Is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm gonna go throw up.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge Matt.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I wanna say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3-8.
9-11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
Call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the wheat being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.